Welcome back, everyone, to Agatha Christie's The Mystery of the Blue Train, a Poirot Mystery, chapters 21 through 23. This is your host, John Hagedorn, and this is 1001 Stories for the Road. And now chapter 21, At the Tennis. Several days had elapsed. Catherine had been for a walk by herself one morning, and came back to find Lennox grinning at her expectantly. "Your young man has been ringing you up, Catherine." "Who do you call my young man?" "A new one. Rufus Van Alden's secretary. You seem to have made rather an impression there. You are becoming a serious breaker of hearts, Catherine. First Derek Kettering, and now this young Knighton. The funny thing is that I remember him quite well. He was in Mother's War Hospital that she ran out here. I was only a kid of about 8 at the time." "Was he badly wounded?" "Shot in the leg, if I remember rightly. Rather a nasty business. I think the doctors messed it up a bit. They said he wouldn't limp or anything, but when he left here he was still completely dot and go one." Lady Tamplin came out and joined them. "Have you been telling Catherine about Major Knighton?" she asked. "Such a dear fellow. Just at first I didn't remember him. One had so many. But now it all comes back." "He was a bit too unimportant to be remembered before," said Lennox. "Now that he's a secretary to an American millionaire, it's a very different matter." "Darling," said Lady Templin, in her vague, reproachful voice. "What did Major Knighton ring up about?" inquired Catherine. "He asked if you would like to go to the tennis this afternoon. If so, he would call for you in a car. Mother and I accepted for you with impressment. Whilst you dally with a millionaire's secretary, you might give me a chance with the millionaire, Catherine. He's about 60, I suppose, so that he will be looking about for a nice, sweet young thing like me." "I should like to meet Mr. Van Alden," said Lady Tamplin earnestly. "One has heard so much of him. Those fine, rugged figures of the Western world." She broke off. "So fascinating," she murmured. "Major Knighton was very particular to say it was Mr. Van Alden's invitation," said Lennox. "He said it so often that I began to smell a rat. You and Knighton would make a very nice pair, Catherine. Bless you, my children." Catherine laughed and went upstairs to change her clothes. Knighton arrived soon after lunch and endured manfully Lady Tamplin's transports of recognition. When they were driving together towards Cannes, he remarked to Catherine, "Lady Tamplin has changed wonderfully little." "In manner or appearance?" "Both. She must be, I suppose, well over 40, but she's a remarkably beautiful woman still."
"She is," agreed Catherine.
"I'm very glad that you could come today," went on Knighton. "Monsieur Poirot is going to be there also. What an extraordinary little man he is. Do you know him well, Miss Gray?" Catherine shook her head. "I met him on the train on the way here. I was reading a detective novel, and I happened to say something about such things not happening in real life. Of course, I had no idea of who he was." "He is a very remarkable person," said Knighton slowly, "and has done some very remarkable things. He has a kind of genius for going to the root of the matter, and right up to the end, no one has any idea of what he's really thinking. I remember I was staying at a house in Yorkshire, and Lady Clanravon's jewels were stolen. It seemed at first to be a simple robbery, but it completely baffled the local police. I wanted them to call in Hercule Poirot, and said he was the only man who could help them, but they pinned their faith to Scotland Yard."
"And what happened?" said Catherine, curiously.
"The jewels were never recovered," said Knighton, dryly.
"Do you really believe in him?"
"I do indeed. The Comte de la Roche is a pretty wily customer. He's wriggled out of most things, but I think he's met his match in Hercule Poirot."
"The Comte de la Roche," said Catherine thoughtfully. "So you really think he did it?"
"Of course." Knighton looked at her in astonishment. "Don't you?"
"Oh, yes," said Catherine hastily. "That is, I mean, if it was not just an ordinary train robbery."
"It might be, of course," agreed the other. "But it seems to me that the Comte de la Roche fits into this business particularly well."
and yet he has an alibi.
Alibis? Knighton laughed. His face broke into his attractive, boyish smile. I confess that you read detective stories, Miss Gray. You must know that anyone who has a perfect alibi is always open to grave suspicion.
Do you think that real life is like that? Asked Catherine, smiling.
Why not? Fiction is founded on fact.
But is rather superior to it, suggested Catherine.
Perhaps. Anyway, if I was a criminal, I should not like to have Hercule Poirot on my track.
No more should I, said Catherine, and laughed.
They were met on arrival by Poirot. As the day was warm, he was attired in a white duck suit with a white camellia in his buttonhole.
"Bonjour, mademoiselle," said Poirot. "I look very English, do I not?"
"You look wonderful," said Catherine, tactfully.
"You mock yourself at me," said Poirot, genially. "But no matter. Papa Poirot, he always laughs the last."
"Where's Mr. Van Alden?" asked Knighton.
"He will meet us at our seats. To tell you the truth, my friend, he is not too well pleased with me. Oh, those Americans, the repose, the calm, they know it not. Mr. Van Alden, he would that I fly myself in the pursuit of criminals to all the byways of Nice."
"I should have thought myself that it would not have been a bad plan," observed Knighton.
"You are wrong," said Poirot. "In these matters one needs not energy, but finesse. At the tennis one meets everyone. That is so important. Ah, there is Mr. Kettering."
Derrick came abruptly up to them. He looked reckless and angry, as though something had arisen to upset him. He and Knighton greeted each other with some frigidity. Poirot alone seemed unconscious of the sense of strain, and chatted pleasantly in a laudable attempt to put everyone at their ease. He paid little compliments.
"It is amazing, Mr. Kettering, how well you speak the French," he observed. "So well that you could be taken for a Frenchman if you chose. That is a very rare accomplishment among Englishmen."
"I wish I did," said Catherine. "I am only too well aware that my French is of painfully British order." They reached their seats and sat down, and almost immediately Knighton perceived his employer signaling to him from the other end of the court, and went off to speak with him.
"Me, I approve of that young man," said Poirot, sending a beaming smile after the departing secretary. "And you, mademoiselle?"
"I like him very much."
"And you, Monsieur Catherine?"
Some quick rejoinder was springing to Derrick's lips, but he checked it as though something in the little Belgian's twinkling eyes had made him suddenly alert. He spoke carefully, choosing his words.
"Knighton is a very good fellow," he said.
Just for a moment, Catherine fancied that Poirot looked disappointed.
"He is a great admirer of yours, Monsieur Poirot," she said, and she related some of the things that Knighton had said. It amused her to see the little man plume himself like a bird, thrusting out his chest and assuming an air of mock modesty that would deceive no one.
"That reminds me, mademoiselle," he said suddenly. "I have a little matter of business I had to speak to you about. When you were sitting talking to that poor lady in the train, I think you must have dropped a cigarette case."
Catherine looked rather astonished.
"I don't think so," she said.
Poirot drew from his pocket a cigarette case of soft blue leather, with the initial K on it in gold.
"No, it's not mine," Catherine said.
"Ah, a thousand apologies. It was doubtless Madame's own. K, of course, stands for Catherine. We were doubtful, because she had another cigarette case in her bag, and it seemed odd that she should have two."
He turned to Derrick suddenly.
"You do not know, I suppose, whether this was your wife's case or not?"
Derrick seemed momentarily taken aback. He stammered a little in his reply.
I don't know. I suppose so."
"It is not yours, by any chance?"
"Certainly not. If it were mine, it would hardly have been in my wife's possession."
Poirot looked more ingenuous and childlike than ever.
"'I thought perhaps you might have dropped it when you were in your wife's compartment,'
he explained guilelessly.
"'I was never there. I've already told the police that a dozen times.'
"'A thousand pardons,' said Poirot, with his most apologetic air. "'It was Mademoiselle here who mentioned having seen you going in.'
He stopped with an air of embarrassment. Catherine looked at Derrick. His face had gone rather white, but perhaps that was her fancy. His laugh, when it came, was natural enough.
"'You made a mistake, Miss Gray,' he said easily. "'From what the police have told me, I gathered that my own compartment was only a door or two away from that of my wife's, though I never suspected the fact at the time. You must have seen me going into my own compartment.'
He got up quickly as he saw Van Alden and Knighton approaching. "'I'm going to leave you now,' he announced. "'I can't stand my father-in-law at any price.' Van Alden greeted Catherine very courteously, but was clearly in a bad humor.
"'You seem fond of watching tennis, Monsieur Poirot,' he growled.
"'It is a pleasure to me, yes,' cried Poirot, placidly.
"'It is as well you're in France,' said Van Alden. "'We're made of sterner stuff in the States. "'Business comes before pleasure there.'
Poirot did not take offense. Indeed, he smiled gently and confidingly at the irate millionaire.
"'Do not enrage yourself, I beg of you. "'Everyone has his own methods. "'Me, I have always found it a delightful and pleasing idea "'to combine business and pleasure together.'
He glanced at the other two. They were deep in conversation, absorbed in each other. Poirot nodded his head in satisfaction, and then leaned towards the millionaire, lowering his voice as he did so.
"'It is not only for pleasure that I am here, Monsieur Van Alden. Observe just opposite us that ill old man, the one with the yellow face and the venerable beard.'
"'Well, what of him?'
"'That,' Poirot said, "'is Monsieur Papapopoulos.
"'A Greek, eh?'
"'As you say, a Greek. "'He is a dealer in antiques of worldwide reputation. "'He has a small shop in Paris, "'and he is suspected by the police of being something quite more.'
"'What?'
"'A receiver of stolen goods, especially jewels. "'There is nothing as to the recutting and resetting of gems that he does not know. He deals with the highest in Europe and with the lowest of the riffraff of the underworld.
Van Alden was looking at Poirot with a suddenly awakened attention.
Well?
He demanded, a new note in his voice.
I ask myself, asked Poirot. I, Hercule Poirot,
he thumped himself dramatically on his chest,
ask myself, why has Monsieur Papapopoulos suddenly come to Nice?
Van Alden was impressed. For a moment he had doubted Poirot and suspected the little man of being past his job, a poseur only. Now, in a moment, he switched back to his original opinion. He looked straight at the little detective.
I must apologize to you, Monsieur Poirot.
Poirot waved the apology aside with an extravagant gesture.
"'Bah!' he cried. "'All that is of no importance. "'Now, listen, Mr. Van Alden. "'I have news for you.'
"'The millionaire looked sharply at him, "'all his interest aroused. "'Poirot nodded.
"'It is as I say. "'You will be interested. "'As you know, Monsieur Van Alden, "'the Comte de la Roche has been under surveillance "'ever since his interview with the Juge d'Instruction.' The day after that, during his absence, the Villa Marina was searched by the police.
Well, said Van Alden, did they find anything? I bet they didn't.
Poirot made him a little bow.
Your acumen is not at fault, Monsieur Van Alden. They found nothing of an incriminating nature. It was not to be expected that they would. The Comte de la Roche, as your expressive idiom has it, was not born on the preceding day. He is an astute gentleman with great experience.
Well, go on, growled Van Alden.
It may be, of course,
that the Comte had nothing of a compromising nature to conceal. But we must not neglect the possibility. If, then, he has something to conceal, where is it? Not in his house. The police searched thoroughly. Not on his person, for he knows that he is liable to arrest at any minute. There remains his car. As I say, he was under surveillance. He was followed on that day to Monte Carlo. From there he went by road to Menton, driving himself. His car is a very powerful one. It outdistanced his pursuers, and for about a quarter of an hour they completely lost sight of him.
And during that time you think he concealed something by the roadside?
Asked Van Alden, keenly interested now. By the roadside, no. Ce n'est pas pratique. But listen now. Me, I have made a little suggestion to Monsieur Carrège. He is graciously pleased to approve of it. In each bureau de poste in the neighborhood, it has been seen, too, that there is someone who knows the Comte de la Roche by sight. Because, you see, messieurs, the best way of hiding a thing is by sending it away by post.
Well? Demanded Van Alden. His face was keenly alight with interest and expectation.
Well, with a dramatic flourish, Poirot drew out from his pocket a loosely wrapped brown paper package from which the string had been removed. During that quarter of an hour's interval, our good gentleman mailed this.
The address? Asked the other sharply.
Poirot nodded his head. Might have told us something, but unfortunately it does not. The package was addressed to one of those little newspaper shops in Paris where letters and parcels are kept until called for on payment of a small commission.
Yes, but what is inside?
Demanded Van Alden, impatiently. Poirot unwrapped the brown paper and disclosed a square cardboard box. He looked round him.
It is a good moment, he said quietly. All eyes are on the tennis. Look, monsieur.
He lifted the lid of the box for the fraction of a second. An exclamation of utter astonishment came from the millionaire. His face turned as white as chalk.
My God! He breathed. The rubies!
He sat for a minute as though dazed. Poirot restored the box to his pocket. Then suddenly the millionaire seemed to come out of his trance. He leaned across to Poirot and wrung his hand so heartily that the little man winced with pain.
This is great, said Van Alden. Great! You are the goods, Monsieur Poirot. Once and for all, you are the goods.
It is nothing, said Poirot modestly. Order, method, being prepared for eventualities beforehand, that is all there is to it.
And now, I suppose, the Comte de la Roche has been arrested?
Continued Van Alden eagerly.
No, said Poirot.
A look of utter astonishment came over Van Alden's face.
But why? What more do you want?
The Comte's alibi is still unshaken.
But that's nonsense.
Yes, said Poirot. I rather think it is nonsense, but unfortunately we have to prove it so.
In the meantime, he will slip through your fingers.
Poirot shook his head very energetically.
No, he said. He will not do that. The one thing the Comte cannot afford to sacrifice is his social position. At all costs, he must stop and brazen it out.
Van Alden was still dissatisfied.
But I don't see. Poirot raised a hand.
Grant me a little moment, monsieur. Me, I have a little idea. Many have mocked themselves at the little ideas of Hercule Poirot, and they have been wrong.
Well, said Van Alden, go ahead. What is this little idea?
Poirot paused for a moment, and then he said,
I will call upon you at your hotel at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Until then, say nothing to anyone.
We'll return with Chapter 22 right after these sponsor messages. And now Chapter 22, Monsieur Papopoulos at Breakfast. Monsieur Papopoulos was at breakfast. Opposite him sat his daughter, Zia. There was a knock at the sitting-room door, and a chasseur entered with a card which he brought to Mr. Papopoulos. The latter scrutinized it, raised his eyebrows, and passed it over to his daughter.
"Ah," said Monsieur Papopoulos, scratching his left ear thoughtfully. "Hercule Poirot. I wonder now."
Father and daughter looked at each other.
"I saw him yesterday at the tennis," said Monsieur Papopoulos. "Zia, I hardly like this."
"He was very useful to you once," his daughter reminded him.
"That is true," acknowledged Monsieur Papopoulos. "Also, he has retired from active work, or so I hear."
These interchanges between father and daughter had passed in their own language. Now Monsieur Papopoulos turned to the chasseur and said in French, "Please bring our guest in." A few minutes later, Hercule Poirot, exquisitely attired, and swinging a cane with a jaunty air, entered the room.
"My dear Monsieur Papopoulos."
"My dear Monsieur Poirot."
"And Mademoiselle Zia."
Poirot swept her a low bow.
"You will excuse us going on with our breakfast," said Monsieur Papopoulos, pouring himself out another cup of coffee. "Your call is, ahem, a little early."
"It is scandalous," said Poirot. "But see you, I am pressed."
"Ah," murmured Monsieur Papopoulos. "You are on an affair, then?"
"A very serious affair," said Poirot. "The death of Madame Catherine."
Let me see."
Monsieur Papopoulos looked innocently up at the ceiling.
"That was the lady who died on the blue train, was it not? I saw a mention of it in the papers, but there was no suggestion of foul play."
"In the interests of justice," said Poirot, "it was thought the best to suppress that fact."
There was a pause.
"In what way can I assist you, Monsieur Poirot?" asked the dealer politely.
"Voilà," said Poirot. "I shall come to the point."
He took from his pocket the same box that he had displayed a can, and opening it, he took out the rubies and pushed them across the table to Papopoulos. Although Poirot was watching him narrowly, not a muscle of the old man's face moved. He took up the jewels and examined them with a kind of detached interest. Then he looked across at the detective inquiringly.
"Superb, are they not?" asked Poirot.
"Quite excellent," said Monsieur Papopoulos. "How much should you say they are worth?"
The Greek's face quivered a little.
"Is it really necessary to tell you, Monsieur Poirot?" he asked. "You are shrewd, Monsieur Papopoulos." "No, it is not. They are not, for instance, worth $500,000.
Papopoulos laughed, and Poirot joined with him.
"As an imitation," said Papopoulos, handing them back to Poirot, "they are, as I said, quite excellent. Would it be indiscreet to ask, Monsieur Poirot, where you came across them?"
"Not at all," said Poirot. "I have no objection to telling an old friend like yourself. They were in the possession of the Comte de la Roche."
Monsieur Papopoulos's eyebrows lifted themselves eloquently.
"Indeed,"
he murmured. Poirot leant forward and assumed his most innocent and beguiling air.
"Monsieur Papopoulos," he said, "I am going to lay my cards upon the table. The original of these jewels was stolen from Madame Catherine on the blue train. Now I will say to you first this. I am not concerned with the recovery of these jewels. That is the affair of the police. I am working not for the police, but for Monsieur Van Alden. I want to lay hands on the man who killed Madame Catherine. I am interested in the jewels only in so far as they may lead me to this man. Do you understand?"
The last two words were uttered with great magnificence. Monsieur Papopoulos, his face quite unmoved, said quietly,
"Go on." "It seems to me probable, monsieur, that the jewels will change hands in Nice. Maybe they have done so."
"Ah,"
said Monsieur Papopoulos. He sipped his coffee reflectively and looked a shade more noble and patriarchal than usual.
I say to myself, continued Poirot, with animation, what good fortune! My old friend, Monsieur Papopoulos, is in Nice. He will aid me.
And how do you think I can aid you? Inquired Monsieur Papopoulos coldly.
I said to myself, without doubt, Monsieur Papopoulos is in Nice on business.
Not at all, said Monsieur Papopoulos. I'm here for my health, by the doctor's orders. He coughed hollowly.
I am desolated to hear it, replied Poirot, with somewhat insincere sympathy. But to continue, when a Russian Grand Duke, an Austrian Archduchess, or an Italian prince wish to dispose of their family jewels, to whom do they go? To Monsieur Papopoulos, is it not? He who is famous all over the world for the discretion with which he arranges these things.
The other bowed. You flatter me.
It is a great thing, discretion,
mused Poirot, and was rewarded by the fleeting smile which passed across the Greek's face.
I, too, can be discreet.
The eyes of the two men met. Then Poirot went on speaking very slowly, and obviously picking his words with care.
I say to myself this, if these jewels had changed hands in Nice, Monsieur Papopoulos would have heard of it. He has knowledge of all that passes in the jewel world.
Ah, said Monsieur Papopoulos, and helped himself to a croissant.
The police, you understand, said Monsieur Poirot, do not enter into the matter. This is a personal affair.
One hears rumors, admitted Monsieur Papopoulos cautiously.
Such as?
Prompted Poirot. Is there any reason I should pass them on?
Yes, said Poirot. I think there is. You may remember, Monsieur Papopoulos, that 17 years ago there was a certain article in your hands, left there as security by a very prominent person. It was in your keeping, and it unaccountably disappeared. You were, if I may use the English expression, in the soup.
His eyes came gently round to the girl. She had pushed her cup and plate aside, and with both elbows on the table and her chin resting on her hands, was listening eagerly. Still keeping an eye on her, he went on.
I was in Paris at the time. You sent for me. You place yourself in my hands. If I have restored to you that article, you say I shall earn your undying gratitude. Eh bien, I did restore it to you.
A long sigh came from Monsieur Papopoulos. It was the most unpleasant moment of my career, he murmured.
17 years is a long time, said Poirot thoughtfully. But I believe that I am right in saying, monsieur, that your race does not forget.
A Greek? Murmured Papopoulos, with an ironical smile.
It was not as a Greek I meant, said Poirot.
There was a silence, and then the old man drew himself up proudly. You are right, Monsieur Poirot, he said quietly. I am a Jew, and as you say, our race does not forget.
You will aid me, then?
As regards the jewels, monsieur, I can do nothing. The old man, as Poirot had done just now, picked his words carefully. I know nothing, I have heard nothing, but I can perhaps do you a good turn. That is, if you are interested in racing.
Under certain circumstances, I might be, said Poirot, eyeing him steadily.
There is a horse running at Longchamps that would, I think, repay attention. I cannot say for certain, you understand. This news passed through so many hands. He stopped, fixing Poirot with his eye, as though to make sure that the latter was comprehending him.
Perfectly,
said Poirot, nodding. The name of the horse, said Monsieur Papopoulos, leaning back and joining the tips of his fingers together, "is the Marquis. I think, but I'm not sure, that it is an English horse. Eh, Zia?"
"I think so, too," said the girl.
Poirot got up briskly.
"I thank you, monsieur," he said. "It is a great thing to have what the English call a tip from the stable. Au revoir, monsieur, and many thanks."
He turned to the girl.
"Au revoir, Mademoiselle Zia. It seems to me but yesterday that I saw you in Paris. One would say that 2 years had passed at most."
"There is a difference between 16 and 33, said Zia ruefully.
"Not in your case," declared Poirot gallantly. "You and your father will perhaps dine with me one night."
"We shall be delighted," replied Zia.
"Then we will arrange it," declared Poirot. "And now, j'ai mes soif."
Poirot walked along the street, humming a little tune to himself. He twirled his stick with a jaunty air. Once or twice he smiled to himself quietly. He turned into the first bureau de poste he came to and sent off a telegram. He took some time in wording it, but it was in code, and he had to call upon his memory. It purported to deal with a missing scarf pin and was addressed to Inspector Japp, Scotland Yard. Decoded, it was short and to the point. "Wire me everything known about the man whose sobriquet is the Marquis." Chapter 23. A New Theory. It was exactly 11 o'clock when Poirot presented himself at Van Alden's hotel. He found the millionaire alone.
"You are punctual, Monsieur Poirot," he said, with a smile, as he rose to greet the detective.
"I am always punctual," said Poirot. "The exactitude. Always do I observe it. Without order and method..."
He broke off.
"Ah, but it is possible that I have said these things to you before. Let us come at once to the object of my visit."
"Your little idea?"
"Yes, my little idea."
Poirot smiled.
"First of all, monsieur, I should like to interview once more the maid, Ada Mason. She is here?"
"Yes, she's here."
"Ah."
Van Alden looked at him curiously. He rang the bell, and a messenger was dispatched to find Mason. Poirot greeted her with his usual politeness, which was never without effect on that particular class.
"Good afternoon, mademoiselle," he said cheerfully. "Be seated, will you not, if monsieur permits?"
"Yes, yes, sit down, my girl," said Van Alden.
"Thank you, sir,"
said Mason primly, and she sat down on the extreme edge of a chair. She looked bonier and more acid than ever.
"I've come to ask you yet more questions," said Poirot. "We must get to the bottom of this affair. Always I return to the question of the man in the train. You have been shown the Comte de la Roche. You say that it is possible he was the man, but you are not sure."
"As I told you, sir, I never saw the gentleman's face. That's what makes it so difficult." Poirot beamed and nodded.
"Precisely. Exactly. I comprehend well the difficulty. Now, mademoiselle, you have been in the service of Madame Catherine 2 months, you say. During that time, how often did you see your master?"
Mason reflected a minute or two and then said,
"Only twice, sir."
"And was that near to or far away?"
"Well, once, sir, he came to Curzon Street. I was upstairs, and I looked over the banisters and saw him in the hall below. I was a bit curious-like, you understand, knowing the way things were."
Mason finished up with her discreet cough.
"And the other time?" "I was in the park, sir, with Annie, one of the housemaids, sir, and she pointed out the master to me walking with a foreign lady."
Again Poirot nodded.
"Now listen, Mason. This man whom you saw in the carriage talking to your mistress at the Gare de Lyon, how do you know it was not your master?"
"The master, sir? Oh, I don't think it would have been."
"But you are not sure,"
Poirot persisted.
"Well, I never thought of it, sir,"
Mason was clearly upset at the idea. "You have heard that your master was also on the train. What more natural than that it should have been he who came along the corridor?"
"But the gentleman who was talking to the mistress must have come from outside, sir. He was dressed for the street, in an overcoat and soft hat."
"Just so, mademoiselle. But reflect a minute. The train has just arrived at the Gare de Lyon. Many of the passengers promenade themselves upon the quay. Your mistress was about to do so, and for that purpose had doubtless put on her fur coat, eh?"
"Yes, sir," agreed Mason.
"Your master, then, does the same. The train is heated, but outside in the station it is cold. He puts on his overcoat and his hat, and he walks along beside the train, and looking up at the lighted windows, he suddenly sees Madame Catherine. Until then, he has no idea that she was on the train. Naturally, he mounts the carriage and goes to her compartment. She gives an exclamation of surprise at seeing him, and quickly shuts the door between the two compartments, since it is possible that their conversation may be of a private nature. He leaned back in his chair and watched the suggestion slowly take effect. No one knew better than Hercule Poirot that the class to which Mason belongs cannot be hurried. He must give her time to get rid of her own preconceived ideas. At the end of 3 minutes, she spoke.
"Well, of course, sir, it might be so. I never thought of it that way. The master is tall and dark, and just about that build. It was seeing the hat and coat that made me say it was a gentleman from outside. Yes, it might have been the master. I would not like to say either way, I am sure."
"Thank you very much, mademoiselle. I shall not require you any further. Oh, just one thing more."
He took from his pocket the cigarette case he had already shown to Catherine.
"Is that your mistress's case?" he said to Mason.
"No, sir. It's not the mistress's. At least—" She looked suddenly startled. An idea was clearly working its way to the forefront of her mind.
"Yes?" said Poirot, encouragingly.
"I think, sir, I can't be sure, but I think it is a case that the mistress bought to give to the master."
"Ah," said Poirot, in a noncommittal manner.
"But whether she ever did give it to him or not, I can't say, of course."
"Precisely," said Poirot, "precisely. That is all, I think, mademoiselle. I wish you good afternoon."
Ada Mason retired discreetly, closing the door noiselessly behind her. Poirot looked across at Van Alden, a faint smile upon his face. The millionaire looked thunderstruck.
You think it was Derek?" he queried. "But everything points the other way. Why, the Count has actually been caught red-handed with the jewels on him."
"No.
But you told me."
"What did I tell you?"
"The story about the jewels. You showed them to me."
"No."
Van Alden stared at him.
"You mean to say you didn't show them to me?"
"No.
Yesterday, at the tennis."
"No."
"Are you crazy, Monsieur Poirot, or am I?"
"Neither of us is crazy," said the detective. "You ask me a question, I answer it. You say, have I not shown you the jewels that day? I reply, no. What I showed you, Van Alden, was a first-class imitation, not to be distinguished except by an expert from the real ones."
Thanks for joining us for Chapters 21, 22, and 23 from The Mystery of the Blue Train by Agatha Christie, a Poirot mystery. If you're enjoying our story, please do stop a moment and send us a review for 1001 Stories for the Road and The Blue Train. Until next week, Sunday, everyone, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.